I'm Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, a Syrian amnesty is met with skepticism. Some Syrian refugees go home to the former Russian Riviera.
Many of them have very useful professions. I mean, electricians have need of them. So many of them already start working, which is very good.
Turkey floats a gas pipeline plan with Israel. And an exhibit at a Berlin Jewish museum stokes debate. It's all ahead. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has declared a general amnesty for crimes committed before today, the latest in a series of similar decrees since the uprising against his rule began more than 2 years ago. State media carried reports of the order, which comes a day before a national holiday celebrating Syria's 1946 independence. For reaction to the decree, we spoke with Abdul Omar, a Syrian opposition activist based in the United Kingdom.
Well, the first reaction is that we need to be very clear on the definition of this amnesty. Bashar al-Assad has neither given any confirmation on the numbers of people that will be released under this amnesty, nor has he made any direct reference to political prisoners or prisoners of thought, as we call them. And most of all, let's not forget, this is not the first amnesty he has given in the last 2 years, and none of his previous amnesties could be described as a major step forward.
Why do you think he does this?
Well, quite simply, tomorrow is the 17th of April, which is a national holiday in Syria. He is expected to give a speech, and in that speech, he is expected to say something new. So he had to fill his slot with something, and I guess the reason why he mentioned this amnesty without any details shows that he has neither thought about it, nor has he got any serious plans. He simply had to say something in this occasion. I think he continues with his plan to pretend to be a reformist, to pretend to give some internal propaganda aimed towards the Syrians, not necessarily the outside world, that this is a person who is trying to build Syria, when in reality he is the person whom the destruction of Syria can be accounted for.
This conflict has been going on for more than 2 years now. Do you see any hope for it being resolved soon?
It depends on our definition of a resolution. Day after day, I'm losing hope in a negotiated or a political solution, precisely because Bashar al-Assad is not showing any willingness to step down, despite seeing his country revolting against him at such a mass scale. And it is simply down now to a battle of wits between the armed rebels and between the actual regime being supported by the Russian and the Iranian governments to help him suppress the uprising.
Do you feel the international community, for instance, the United States, should step in?
I think the international community must step in more ways than one. I think the number one thing the international community has the obligation to do is to ensure that Syrian civilians, both as refugees outside the country and inside the country, are not starving. We keep on talking about the military solution and support militarily. I struggle to see how genuine the international community is with these talks when they are failing at the simple provisions of medical and humanitarian aid.
What about arms?
Arms, I believe, are slowly becoming a necessity as the only way out. We have very few options, and we don't have any good options right now. We've only got a bad option and a worse option. The bad option is to arm the rebels to the point where they can tip the balance. The worst option is to keep things as it is at a stalemate, which only means that the conflict will drag on and on to destroy the country even further and cause even more bloodbaths.
Abdul Omar, a Syrian opposition activist based in the United Kingdom. Meanwhile, the heads of five United Nations agencies charged with assisting those affected by the Syrian crisis say there is a lack of urgency among governments and other parties that could stop the bloodshed. The UN humanitarian chief, the High Commissioner for Refugees, and the leaders of the World Food Program, World Health Organization, and UN Children's Fund called on leaders to meet their responsibilities to the Syrian people. They urged officials to insist on a political solution and said the UN is precariously close to suspending some humanitarian aid. As Syria's civil war grinds into its third year, ethnic and religious minorities feel increasingly insecure. Armenian Christians have left for Beirut or for Armenia. Members of another ethnic group who have lived in Syria for generations are finding a safe haven farther afield. James Brook reports from Georgia's breakaway territory of Abkhazia.
Syria's civil war has created 1 million international refugees. Many live in border camps in Turkey, in Jordan, or in Lebanon. But a lucky few are finding shelter on the Black Sea coast, here in Abkhazia, a breakaway territory of Georgia. This sunny strip of beaches and forests once was called Russia's Riviera. They are Syrian Abkhaz, coming home 150 years after the Russian Tsar deported their Muslim ancestors from here to Turkey. Elbrus Abkhaza was a French teacher in Damascus. He explains why he came here.
C'est mon origine, Brésil.
He says he followed Abkhazia's independence before Syria's civil war. Now, his roots have drawn him here. In 1991, when the Soviet Union collapsed and Georgia won its independence, Abkhaz separatists demanded independence in turn from Georgia. In 1993, Abkhaz forces, supported by Russia, drove Georgian soldiers out of most of Abkhazia. After Russia defeated Georgia in a brief war in 2008, Russia established permanent military bases in Abkhazia. Walid Wajuk fought against Georgia 2 decades ago as a volunteer from the Abkhaz diaspora. 6 months ago, when Syria's war came to his Damascus suburb, this flower seller and father of three moved his family to his ancestral homeland, Abkhazia.
Лучше, а где место жить мирно.
He says the best place is where you can live peacefully. Here, the breakaway government helps migrants, and Abkhaz are welcomed. With Abkhazia now peaceful, the Syrian refugees have moved into blue and white housing recently vacated when a UN ceasefire observer mission ended work here. The self-proclaimed Abkhazian government's foreign minister, Vyacheslav Chidigpa, says 200 Syrian Abkhaz have already arrived. Another 150 are to come by the end of April.
We want to help our brothers who are in need and in danger now in Syria and to assist them in any way possible which we can provide them.
Although few refugees speak Russian or Abkhaz, he said they are needed as Abkhazia slowly rebuilds.
Many of them have very useful professions. I mean, electricians, we have need of them. So many of them already start working, which is very good.
At Abkhaz State University, Beslan Baratelia says Abkhazia has a long-standing program to encourage ethnic Abkhaz to come home from Turkey.
Политика репатриации проводится в Абхазии уже лет 20.
He says a repatriation fund helps members of the Abkhaz diaspora find houses and jobs here. Many houses here are empty. After separatist forces won control of Abkhazia in 1993, half of Abkhazia's population, 200,000 ethnic Georgians, fled the territory. In Tbilisi, Georgia, demonstrators say that if Abkhazia wants to boost its population, it should let Georgians return to their houses. All major nations, with the exception of Russia and Venezuela, support the refugees' right to return, as well as the departure of Russian troops and the return of Abkhazia to some form of Georgian control. But Izita Chania, editor of Nuzhnia Gazeta in Suhumi, says the population policy is deliberately ethnic, not economic. She says the goal is to increase the quantity of ethnic Abkhaz living in Abkhazia. So Abkhazia rebuilds its population, drawing ethnic Abkhaz refugees from 1,000 kilometers away and shunning ethnic Georgian refugees from 100 kilometers away. James Brook, VOA News, Suhumi, Georgia.
Congratulations to the winner of the VOA Photo Contest. During the month of February, we invited listeners, viewers, and web visitors from around the world to submit photos depicting the spirit of the communities in which they live. There were more than 4,500 entries from 110 countries. But the top prize goes to Rahan Parvez from Dhaka for his black and white portrait of an older woman protecting her grain from 3 hungry ducklings. To see the winner and runners-up, visit our website at voanews.com. As diplomatic relations between Israel and Turkey thaw, Turkey's energy minister says that a pipeline project between the two countries could become possible. Ankara is keen to make the country an energy hub for the region. But Turkey's ruling party is having to balance sensitivities of families of the victims of a 2010 military operation by Israel on a Gaza-bound flotilla. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
The Turkish energy minister, Taner Yildiz, says his country would be open to the construction of a pipeline to distribute Israel's newly discovered gas. The announcement follows Israel's apology to Turkey over the 2010 killing of 9 Turks aboard an aid ship trying to break an Israeli economic embargo of the Gaza Strip. Turkish international relations expert Soli Özel of Istanbul's Kadir Has University says energy cooperation offers benefits for both countries.
The issue may become an important topic on which the two can cooperate. The Israelis have already made a suggestion to send some of their gas via pipelines to Turkey, and that actually fits well with Turkey's grand desire to basically the grill, full of pipelines from north to south, from east to west, and therefore become, on energy matters as well, if not necessarily exactly a hub, but certainly an indispensable transition place.
But the thorny question of compensation to Turkish flotilla victims remains. The Israeli government has promised to compensate the families of those killed. Turkey's Deputy Prime Minister, Bülent Arınç, says both sides want a speedy resolution of the issue.
İsrail'den bir heyet gelecek ve tazminatlar konusundaki çalışmamızı...
Arınç says Israelis would like to pay the compensation immediately and would like to solve the issue as soon as possible. He says compensation will bring an end to ongoing court cases in Turkey against the Israelis involved, a key demand of Israel. Israeli and Turkish diplomats are due to meet in Ankara next week to discuss compensation. A senior Turkish diplomat who spoke on condition of anonymity said he hopes it will be resolved during the visit. But analyst Özel says even if compensation is paid, the stalled Mideast peace process hangs as a detriment to bettering Turkish-Israeli relations.
The fundamental thing is the Israelis have no interest in granting a Palestinian state worthy of its name. And Turkey would like the rest of the world, by the way, a Palestinian state, a two-state solution, decent living for the Palestinians and get it over with. This is a difference that cannot be reconciled.
The Turkish Foreign Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu has linked Israel's ending its economic embargo on Hamas-run Gaza to a full normalization of Israeli-Turkish relations. Diplomatic columnist Simi Idiz, who writes for Turkey's Taraf newspaper, says the government has to be sensitive to criticism from its Islamist wing of its party. Still, Idiz believes the support of Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan could change the tide.
They don't like it. They want a sort of Israel to be punished for this and to disappear and all that. I don't think the government is taking this lightly. And yes, the government has to manage this. But in the long run, I think that the Islamic wind grudgingly accepts it for the sake of pragmatism.
And they say both countries have important mutual interests, along with energy. They both have borders with Syria and oppose the Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad. Also, both are allies of the United States. And Washington is strongly backing rapprochement efforts. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul, Turkey.
An exhibit at Berlin's Jewish Museum aims to educate museum goers about Jews in Germany today. Nearly 180,000 German Jews were killed in the Holocaust, almost the entire community in Germany, in the lead-up to World War II. Today, the number of Jews in Germany has grown, but the percentage of Germany's total population is still minuscule. One display in the show has a Jew sitting in a plexiglass box answering questions about Jews from visitors to the museum. Some critics say the show is degrading, and headline writers have dubbed the exhibit Jew in a Box. But the show, Michael Scatoro tells us from Berlin, seems less controversial to those visiting. He prepared this report for VOA Television.
The exhibit at Berlin's Jewish Museum seeks to answer frequently asked questions about Jews. Are all Jews religious? What makes food kosher? What do Jews wear on their heads, and why? And who can become a Jew? One display is a plexiglass cube open at the front where a Jewish person sits every day but Saturday, the Jewish Sabbath, answering questions from museum goers. On a recent day, Signe Rosbach, a Jew from Berlin, sat in the cube and talked to non-Jews who approached. She said she wanted to participate because most Germans have never met a Jew.
They don't meet any Jews, most of them. And I thought this was a great idea.
This German-Canadian couple were surprised by the cube, but they liked it.
I always seem to find that Germans, my husband being one, and his family are very undereducated when it comes to knowing who the victims of, you know, at their hands in the Second World War were. They don't really have any understanding of what a Jew is culturally.
Robert is her husband.
We come from a generation, so we still, like, have at least part of the guilt in us, even though us, we never did anything.
Curator Michael Friedlander, who was also Jewish, says she was motivated by the fact that many young Germans say the Holocaust was so long ago that there's no need to discuss it today.
We want them to continue to remember the terrible history, but perhaps there's a new way to enter into dialogue.
Historian Alexander Haskell, another visitor, said the box is a good idea.
This exposition is an experiment. It can really fail when at the end we will see everybody's just laughing and nothing else. But maybe it opens new ways to deal with Judaism, also taking into account that also German society is evolving and Jews are a part of this society.
The exhibit runs until September 1st of this year. Michael Scuturo for VOA News in Berlin.
This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.